This podcast is supported by the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
Hey everyone, it's Estet Herndon, political reporter for the New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent, I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what the New York Times has been doing for more than a century, and that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to the New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
And so I'm not saying that it's guaranteed I win, but name me a nominee who's taken as many hits from the beginning of them announcing, even though I announced late, who has taken the hits. And I'm, you know, you all declare me, not you, editorially in a broad sense, declare me dead. And guess what? I ain't dead. And I'm not going to die.
Hi, I'm Katie Kingsbury from the New York Times editorial board. And welcome to The Choice, a new podcast that brings you behind closed doors and into the exclusive deliberations process around the New York Times pick for the 2020 presidential candidate. In each episode, you'll hear Democratic presidential candidates make their pitch as they interview for the biggest job of their career. Every election year, the board chooses a candidate after closed-door, off-the-record interviews and a lot of internal debate. But the stakes are so high in 2020, and we think voters deserve to hear how we decided on our pick as the best candidate to beat Donald Trump. So we're giving you access to these conversations and the debates that followed so you can make the choice for yourself. To learn more about how the board works and who's on it, go back and listen to episode one of this series. We've trimmed each of these interviews down, but if you'd like to read the full transcript, you can find them on nytimes.com/endorsements. That's endorsements with an S. Our last interview was with the current frontrunner, who undoubtedly has the most name recognition, former Vice President Joe Biden.
Big moment here for former Vice President Joe Biden. He just released that announcement, making it official, saying he is running for president.
Delaware elected Joe Biden its senator at just 29 years old. He was immediately tapped as promising White House material. Pundits mapped out the earliest presidential election he'd be eligible to run in. Vice President Biden's first attempt at the White House was in 1988, when he ran to be the youngest president since John F. Kennedy at 45 years old. But his campaign flamed out fast when he was found to be plagiarizing political speeches. This time around, he's campaigning to be the oldest president in American history, running on his 6 terms as senator and 8 years as Barack Obama's vice president. Previous presidential campaigns aside, Mr. Biden has had one of the most decorated political careers of anyone in the field. As chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, he played major roles in the contentious Supreme Court nominations of Robert Bork and Clarence Thomas. In the 1990s, he helped write and pass the Violence Against Women Act, the first legislation of its kind to put federal resources toward combating domestic and sexual violence. But Mr. Biden also wrote and passed the tough-on-crime laws that have contributed to our era of mass incarceration. He has since walked back his stance and called the crime bill, quote, a big mistake. In more recent years, however, Mr. Biden played an active role in the passage of the Affordable Care Act during his time as vice president. And like Senator Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg, Mr. Biden is a more centrist option in the party, advocating for civility in politics and getting things done through a bipartisan strategy. His 2020 campaign has had a number of stumbles along the way, but many working-class voters see him as one of their own. We wanted to dig deeper into Mr. Biden's policies and some moments on the campaign trail that have given us pause. We apologize for the audio being rough at times. We recorded in a glass room overlooking the beautiful Port Authority bus terminal using wireless mics that are great for television, but not ideal for podcasting. And a heads up, at a few points throughout the interview, you'll hear a cell phone alert go off as Mr. Biden has some difficulty silencing a phone he had with him.
So, Mr. Vice President, we're hoping to ask you a few questions that we haven't really heard you answer on the campaign trail yet.
Okay.
Mr. Vice President, why don't you support reparations for Black Americans?
Well, I do support reparations for Black Americans, and the best way to get reparations for Black Americans ends systemic segregation. And it's real, and it's genuine. I've spent my whole career doing that. The first thing I did as a young councilman and lawyer was to fight redlining. And so I think that the reparations argument and debate is worth people investigating it, but how do you make that judgment? In the meantime, there's a lot we have to do right now to deal with the original sin of America, which is slavery. And so I think it's much more productive to move quickly on everything from access to education to loans. I mean, why in God's name is a situation where you can own a home, exact same home, on one side of the street, which is predominantly Black, and you own the exact home across the street, which is predominantly white, and your home will be valued less and your insurance will cost more? It's wrong. There's a whole range of things we can do legislatively now to deal with this systemic racism that still exists.
You said during the September debate, when asked about reparation, that Black parents should, among other things, make sure that you have the record player on at night. How specifically should the country confront its history of slavery, discrimination, and plunder of Black Americans?
Well, I think you're taking that out of context, but that's okay.
Actually, it wasn't out of context.
No, well, okay. The idea is that the responsibility rests on those who are still engaged in oppression to stop what they're doing and pay for what they've done. If it's criminal, and if it's not criminal, pay for it economically and change the law. I remember how much trouble Barack got in when he said that parents, Black parents, should take responsibility. That wasn't my point. My point was to make it clear that there are a number of things we can do now to help parents who have been disadvantaged as a consequence of lack of opportunity to be able to provide more guidance and better guidance for themselves and their families. For example, we have one school psychologist for every 1,507 kids in public schools. It's ridiculous.
Is there anything that you have changed your mind about related, I would say, to your record or your thinking, your personal views, on race or busing or anything over the years?
No, not on race or busing, because, you know, I think you've all been kind of shocked how much Black support I have. And I've never been ashamed of anything I have done. I've fought for the African-American community and fought for them my entire career. I made a big mistake in the criminal justice side when it's easy to forget it now, but you know, when all of a sudden crack was introduced as a great threat to the United States of America. And you had medical folks at the time saying, well, crack goes straight to the brain. It's going to have this long-term effect. So we bought on to the idea that crack somehow should be punished much more significantly than, in fact, powdered cocaine. Well, what it meant was somebody snorting powder in the parties you guys go to. I don't mean you. No, I didn't mean it that way. But wealthy neighborhoods, if they were to get arrested, which they don't in the first place, but if they were to get arrested, they get a sentence that's 100 times less than someone is getting convicted for a crack. And so from the time we passed that, 2 years after, I've been trying to change it and I've been unable to do it. Barack and I got it down to a 10 to 1 from 100 to 1. It should be zero, but it's had a disproportionate impact on minority communities, particularly African-American communities. I sorely regret that. And we've also learned a lot more about drug abuse overall. We used to deal with it in terms of we thought that mental illness was a product of drug abuse. It's the reverse. Mental illness is the reason for drug abuse.
One of the things I had wanted to ask you about was you've called for rescheduling marijuana so that scientists can better study its therapeutic potential. Virtually all of your opponents have gone further and actually called for full legalization at the federal level. Can you make the case to me for why to take the more moderate approach when it seems
that most... I think science matters. I mean, one of the reasons I'm running against the guy I'm running against is, you know, science matters, not fiction. What I'm arguing is there have been studies showing that it complicates other problems if you already have a problem with certain drugs. And so we should just study it and decriminalize it, but study it and find out. Get the medical community to come up with a final definitive answer as to whether or not it does cause, and if it does cause other problems, then make it clear to people so that's a place you do not engage in the use of it.
But so many states have already legalized it.
Sure they have. I get that. But that doesn't mean the science shouldn't be looked at.
Couldn't you promote the science and legalize it at the federal level in tandem?
No. Well, why would you promote the science if the science would say it would be a bad idea to legalize it? You got to find out the facts first. But let's get some straight here. I've argued for some time, total decriminalization. Anyone who has a record, it should be immediately expunged. So when you come to work for the New York Times and they ask if you have any problems, you don't any criminal arrest, you don't have to say yes, because it will be completely expunged. It. And anyone who is, in fact, has been served any time in prison or is in prison, which a few people are these days, that they immediately be released and the record totally expunged.
As the second oldest Democratic candidate, Mr. Biden has highlighted some of the generational gaps in his ability to relate to younger voters like millennials.
He's even gone as far as to say he had no empathy for their generation's problems, like mounting student loan debt. Naturally, we asked him to put that in context.
You've expressed very little interest in entertaining millennials' concerns and complaints about the problems that they face, whether it's student debt. Well, you have said, I have no empathy for it. Give me a break, in terms of like things that they've been concerned about with the way in which the older generations have more or less made things worse for them as a generation. So, do you think that millennials have less of a burden?
So let's get it straight, okay? Mm-hmm. What I said I had no sympathy about was, I made a commencement speech, I don't know which one, either Yale or Harvard, back-to-back 2 years. And a study came out showing that although there was the most generous, most progressive, most involved generation in history, the best educated, which I paid tribute to because I have three granddaughters are all part of that, and my daughter is a social worker with a master's degree, doing great work, et cetera. It also said something like only 16% of young millennials would, in fact, run for public office. So I was at a university, and they said, well, why should we get involved? It's all dirty. I said, I want to hear it. Don't whine to me. I got the same lecture in 1972 when I was in the middle of it. There was a Vietnam War. Where I got the same thing was told in 1965 when I got involved in the civil rights movement. Don't get involved, but you got to get involved.
Some could argue that you're sort of painting a broad brush of the millennials.
I was answering questions. The question was, why should I get involved? I said, because it's your responsibility. You have a responsibility.
So do you think that this younger generation as a whole is not participating enough and they don't have the same burdens as previous generations?
No. What's happening is it's awakened now. The point I always make is, if in fact the generation between 18 and 30 voted in the same percentage though above 30, there would have been 5.2 million more votes cast last year. And we wouldn't have this president we have. We wouldn't have him. They sat home, didn't get involved. And where I come from, you don't say, well, that's your choice. That's okay. Don't lecture me on responsibility, not you. Don't have them lecture me on responsibility and then not participate. When I got involved, it was like, drop out, go to Haight-Ashbury, don't get involved. Literally across the board. You don't trust anybody over 30. And all of a sudden, things got so damn bad, a generation said, enough, enough. And we got involved. And we ran. Look, there's two ways generations get engaged. One, by inspirational people like the John Kennedys of the world. Another, by really bad presidents and really bad things that are happening. This guy is engaging everywhere I go. Everywhere I go, there's more and more and more young people. Everywhere I go, I talk about the need for them to get engaged. And by the way, I do as well with those millennials as anybody else does as a percentage. Bernie does the best. The old guy, like me, he does the best. And I'm the only one that has support across the spectrum of every single element of the Democratic Party. So, I mean, this idea I'm anti-millennial, I mean...
Well, I didn't say that, but...
Well, I didn't say you said it, but the implication is I don't care much about them. I mean, I care like the devil about them. They are the future.
Since you just called yourself the old guy, Jimmy Carter has said that he wouldn't be up for the job of the presidency at age 80. He's obviously experienced the job. How do you respond to comments like that? Are you too old to be running for president?
Watch me. All this stuff about lack of energy. Come get in the bus with me. 16 hours a day. 10 days in a row. Come, join me.
Do you have an exercise routine?
Every morning.
What is it?
I do three things. I bike, treadmill, and I lift. When you get to the White House, you get a medical doc that gets assigned to you. And one of them was a colonel in the United States Army who, when I had a separated shoulder and I ended up having an operation, seven screws put in the shoulder to put it back together again, doing therapy. And he sends me every morning, a exercise routine. And I do it every morning. And I'm not in bad shape.
Do you think it's legitimate for voters to be concerned about people in their later 70s running
sure.
for the highest office in the
yeah,
land?
Yeah, just like it's legitimate for people to ask about whether you're mature enough when you're 35. I'm not joking. I mean, I went through the same thing when I was 29 years old. Well, wait a minute. Are you old enough? And so it's totally legitimate.
So we have a 35-year-old limit. Should we have one at the top end, too?
No.
Should there be a top? Why not?
Because why would you? Show me where it's been a problem.
Well, President Reagan.
Yeah.
Constitution.
Well, look, guys, I think you guys are engaging in ageism here. I mean, now, look, all kidding aside, I don't think they're... The voters will be able to make a judgment. You'll make a judgment whether or not you think I have all my cognitive capability, I'm physically capable, and I have the energy to do the job.
So now your message is one. You're running on experience, a restoration of sanity, invocations of the Obama era. So how do you convince younger voters that you're the person to help move the party into the future?
My message isn't that I'm going to return to the Obama era. My message is twofold. One, I think we'd all agree, is going to inherit a divided nation. And secondly, going to inherit a world in disarray. I believe that my experience in both those areas better equips me than anybody running either party to deal with both those issues. I have a record where I have gotten big things done. I've been able to work with the opposition. I've been able to work not all the time when I haven't been able to have them join. I've gone out and beaten them. I went into 24 states. And I went into the red states, and I went into the purple states, and we won. Some of you suggested when I said we'd win back 41 seats, there goes Biden again. We won 41 seats because I was convinced that the American people understood finally what they didn't understand before. They didn't know what Obamacare was. They didn't know Obama did it. They didn't even know why they had it. They weren't even sure. And all of a sudden, when it starts getting taken away, they're aware of it. When I'm president, I'm inheriting a different world than Barack inherited. But some of the things that were left on the table are the same kind of massive things that are going to have to be dealt with. For example, we got a world in disarray. Who's going to be able to stand on the stage the first day and command the respect of the world leaders? I think I'm the only one who has that experience. That experience matters a lot. I'll deal with different problems. My job will be not to go back to the old days, but be able to reestablish our alliances, keep the world from falling apart, keep NATO from disintegrating, et cetera. The same way, for example, climate change. I'm one of the guys that put that climate change deal together. But it requires someone who the rest of the world is going to respect when they ask them to come to the United States, 100 of them, somewhere between 180 and 200, sit down and say, we have to up the ante now. The politics has changed in terms of what is actually happening in the environment.
After nearly 50 years in politics, Mr. Biden has had his fair share of political baggage. And in the 2020 political climate, that baggage has drawn a lot of criticism.
One of the things you have to deal with in addition to just questions about basic age is, as long as you've been in public life, you have baggage. And you've had in debates
That's right.
a couple of times you've had a little trouble answering for positions that you held decades ago. Which I think is a bit ridiculous that that's an issue, but those questions aren't going to go away. So have you had time to figure out a strategy for just answering kind of the basic approach to this?
The answer is yes. If you notice, They've hit me on every single thing I could be hit on so far. That's the good news. Every aspect of my record, period, has been hit by Trump and by the people I'm running against. And I'm a big boy. My dad used to have an expression, never complain and never explain. And guess what? I'm still leading in all the polls, okay? And that's number one. Number two, if you take a look and what they call these debates, they're not debates. They're 30 to 45 second assertions. Because what comes to me all the time is the attack. I get to speak, but I get to speak in response to an attack. And one of the things that I have to admit to you, I've had difficulty accommodating, is how do you turn to someone who is attacking you on something that I know they know is not true and do it in a way that doesn't look like you're being dismissive, particularly if it's a person of color or if it's a woman. And so I've had to learn how to deal with that. I mean, look, you have a situation where when I was attacked on busing, it's acknowledged now. The woman who attacked me had this exact same position I have. Exact. No different. None.
One of the most controversial positions Mr. Biden has held has been his stance on the Hyde Amendment. This amendment is a law that prohibits Medicaid coverage for abortions, except in the case of rape, incest, or when a pregnancy poses a threat to the patient's life. We wanted to better understand the former vice president's position on this and what he would do as president to protect Roe v. Wade.
Mr. Vice President, I'd love to ask you about reproductive rights.
Yes.
So I think it's fair to say that this is a pretty extraordinary moment for reproductive rights. They're more threatened than they probably have been since Roe v. Wade was passed.
I agree.
And I think that there's a lot of people who question whether you will go on the offensive for reproductive rights as much as is going to be necessary with Roe v. Wade under threat, given the fact that you are pro-choice, certainly, but you switched your position on Hyde only just recently. And for instance, you also originally argued for greater exemptions to the contraception mandate in Obamacare. And so I think there's some concern out there.
No, I didn't, by the way.
You didn't?
No, I was in the opposite side of that.
There was a lot of reporting from the time that said that you were arguing, I think it was a political strategy, right? That it might be read as trampling on religious freedom. But that's not correct?
No. What is not correct is the idea that the argument was what the president put out initially was different than what ended up meaning finally the final position on. And the question was, would I defend the president? I don't want to get into this.
Okay, how about we focus on
anyway,
Hyde then?
I can explain Hyde.
Please do.
First of all, everybody's voted for Hyde. Every single person running
is voting. Well, because it's in the spending
bill. No, I understand. I got it. But they all, this idea, this is such a principle thing.
Well, it's principled. I mean, most of the party has been in favor of overturning Hyde.
Yeah, no, I understand that. I understand that. Look, let me answer the question directly. I thought that when there were reasonable alternatives and funding mechanisms that did not deny women the opportunity to take advantage of their constitutional right under Roe v. Wade as amended by Casey, that in fact it was okay to not make other people who had strong views different than that pay for it. But when in fact we decided that we were going to move to, which I've wanted to do a long time ago and everybody has, is to have basically universal health care, that option is eliminated. It's not available if it's basically universal health care. You cannot say that the poor women are now going to be covered by Medicaid and or, in my plan, a Medicare option to Obamacare, and then expect that there's going to be mechanisms by which they could still get the kind of help they got through private contributions and Planned Parenthood, which rated me 100%. And so that's why I changed the position.
So, Mr. President, though, the thing is, under the Hyde Amendment, it has been the case since 1976 that women who are Medicaid, women who are in the armed services, and other women have not had access to reproductive health care if they can't afford it. So I guess I don't understand how it is that by changing the health care plan that...
By changing the health care plan, that's the only vehicle people are actually going to have because people aren't spending the money on supporting these other alternatives that are available for people. That's what's changed. And look what the states have done. There's been an all-out attack.
But if you're saying women should have access, and they have not had access, poor women specifically have not had access since 1976.
They have had access to other means by which they could get the help, not as nearly...
For many women, that hasn't been the case. Women have suffered. Women have died.
I don't disagree with you.
If you cannot afford to have the procedure, then you have to turn...
But before... What existed was there was vehicles by which there were organizations that provided the procedure for free. They didn't need to pay for it. But when you make it all a federal program, that makes it impossible. Here's the deal. If, in fact, and I've said this for a while, if, in fact, this court comes along, all these draconian laws that are being passed, and what's happening now? It's all designed to go to the Supreme Court in the hope the Supreme Court will, in fact, by a 5-4 decision, rule against Roe v. Wade and or amend it some way as it relates to Casey. And if that were to occur, I will immediately send to the United States Congress legislative requirement, legislating and codifying Roe v. Wade as amended by Casey and put it in the law.
Would you give us any names of people that you might consider to nominate to the court?
No, but there are at least a half a dozen I've already gone through and people I've gone through in the past and who are available now.
Do you think you would...
The moment I do that, you know what will happen.
Well, Donald Trump did it in 2016 and it...
I am not Donald Trump.
Don't ever confuse me with anything having to do with Donald Trump. There's been a criticism of Democrats and people on the left in general that they don't get the significance of the court to the country and to the policies of the country. And I think what Donald Trump understood, and it seemed to work for him, was that by signifying whom he would choose, it made a difference to a lot of voters. Would you consider doing that at least once?
I will tell them the kind of person I would choose. No names.
I was kind of curious. What kind of person? What are you looking for in the Supreme Court?
They have to have an expansive view of the Constitution, recognize the right to privacy, unenumerated rights that exist in the Constitution, not the Federalist Society view that if it's not listed, it doesn't exist. And they have to be, if they acknowledge their unenumerated rights and a right to privacy in the Constitution, the penumbra of the Ninth Amendment, then, in fact, that means I know they will, in fact, support Roe v. Wade. They'll support a woman's right to choose and a whole range of other things that relate to individual personal rights. That is critical. I've written about it extensively. I've written large articles about it. I've presided over more judges and more Supreme Court nominees than anybody else has. Look at the people I supported. I'd look at the philosophy of the judge, their background, and their judicial temperament, whether or not they have the temperament to be on the court. And there are a number of really qualified people out there. I must tell you, my overall predilection would be to look for and put more women on the court, because it's part of getting down through the cultural morass here. Because unless we have courts that look like the public, people lack confidence in them.
You keep saying that you want to change culture. I think, going back to the young people for a moment, I think a lot of them are having trouble believing that as long as you've been in Washington, D.C., that you actually do want to change the culture, because you've had a lot of time in Washington to change
the culture. I wrote the Violence Against Women Act. I also the guy that made sure Slobodan Milosevic got tried as a war criminal. I'm also the guy who went in and got 150,000 troops out of Iraq. I've done a lot of things that, in fact, are progressive, very progressive. And what I'm proposing, the other thing I find interesting is that we talk about whether or not my program is progressive. If I'm able to pass what I'm talking about, my administration will go down in history as one of the most progressive administrations in American history, because we're talking about fundamental changes in the environment, fundamental change in dealing with healthcare, fundamental change in dealing with education. And it's real.
And if Mitch McConnell is still in charge of the Senate, how will you get those things passed?
It takes me to this next point. The next president of the United States, the nominee, has to be able to win in states that, in fact, are up for grabs and we can win. I'm beating Trump in Texas, Florida, North Carolina, Georgia, and all those Midwestern states, which I will win in a walk. But we have to be able, if we do not engage and nationally in the states where there's a chance to win a House member or a senator or change the legislative body, we are not doing our job. Think about all the times when there was real change take place. The presidents have not only gotten elected, they brought along Democratic majorities. We have to win back the Senate. We have to win, and we can. We can. And so what I think, respectfully, people are going to have to consider is, okay, who among the candidates will enhance the prospect we can win a Senate seat in Texas? Who among the prospective candidates is going to enhance the prospect of winning Georgia?
In 2003, in December, Wesley Clark was the leading, winning the polls.
Oh, don't get married. Come on, be fair, okay? Wesley Clark. I know Wes. He's a good guy. I've been consistently leading in the polls after taking all the hits. I go down, and everybody who's hit me is out. They come back. I mean, I don't mean it's guaranteed, but look at all of the data. And so I'm not saying that it's guaranteed I win, but name me a nominee who's taken as many hits from the beginning of them announcing, even though I announced late, who has taken the hits. You all declare me, not you, editorially in a broad sense, declare me dead. And guess what? I ain't dead. And I'm not going to die.
Mr. Vice President, can I follow up on...
Everybody dies.
No, I'm not going to die politically.
What do you think you could accomplish now after even more years of partisanship with Mitch McConnell?
What Mitch McConnell is finding out, and a lot of Republicans are, that they're going to have a hell of a lot of baggage to carry going in to win their own reelections. Look what we just did in Virginia. I campaigned all through Virginia. Look what we just won in Kentucky. I campaigned in Kentucky. You all were saying we can't win that governorship in Kentucky. I'm pretty good at this, knowing where to go. My point is I can't guarantee anything, but I can guarantee that I know how to campaign to help people win. And in all of those states we're talking about, the Democrat who they most would rather have run in their state to help them raise money and get votes is me. That could change. But at the moment, think about it. Do you think that name the other candidates? Who's going to go in North Carolina and help that candidate win? Is it going to be value added? And don't tell me, I shouldn't say don't tell me, I'm being rude. The fact is, if you take a look, it matters who is at the top of the ticket. It matters the resources they have.
Speaking of those other candidates, several of them have proposed major structural reforms to our government and to our democracy. These include abolishing the Electoral College, expanding the size of the Supreme Court, setting term limits for justices, abolishing the legislative filibuster. Which, if any, of these do you support?
None.
Why not?
Because that structural change requires constitutional amendments. It raises problems that are more damaging than the problems that exist. We're in a situation where the reason they gave judges lifetime tenure, you know why.
And you think with a legislative filibuster in place, even if you control the Senate, that you're going to move any of your agenda?
Yes.
How?
Because there's a lot of things people agree on. There's two things. One is that there are a number of areas where you can reach consensus that relate to things like cancer and health care and a whole range of things. I think we can reach consensus on that and get it passed without change the filibuster rule. There are other areas where if you were to change the rule, first of all, if you couldn't get it changed, if you can't get 60 votes, the fact you're going to amend the Constitution on judicial independence is kind of a stretch. And what I love hearing my colleagues say that I'm running with is saying, well, I'm going to buy executive order. And my mother was, who died and left them boss? We have three branches of government.
Agreed. That's why I'm wondering how you're planning to do this with, you had a front row seat to Republican opposition in the Obama administration.
Yeah, we still got a lot of things. Well, I tell you what, I was able to get every Democrat to vote on the floor to make sure we passed Obamacare.
Number two, I was able to. All of your opponents want to change.
Sure, they want to change, but they don't want to eliminate it. Who's out there saying, I'm going to get rid of it? The ones who want to change it, they're saying, look, I know I can't get mine done for 3, 4, 5, 10 years. In the meantime, what are you going to do? I'm going to take Biden's plan in the meantime. I'm going to expand Obamacare. Come on. Look, part of this is what can reasonably be done that fundamentally changes the dynamic that everybody has access to adequate health care. And the fastest, quickest, and most extensive way to do that is my plan to take Obamacare, further subsidize it to the tune of another $750 billion over 10 years, add a public option, provide for that for anybody who wants it, allow the 160 million Americans who seem to like their hard-negotiated health care, keep it if they want it. If they don't want it, they can buy in, and or if they don't have the money, they automatically are admitted into the plan.
Your public option plan has a lot of promising features, but it's still quite a heavy lift. The public option that was attached to the Affordable Care Act did not get through the Senate. What's different this time?
Gigantic difference.
And yours is much more ambitious than that earlier.
Sure it is. And I'm glad you raised that. Two things. One, every Democratic president since Roosevelt tried to do what Barack got done. And it was a really heavy lift to get it done. It was a gigantic step forward. But even when it got done, the arguments, or I can say this now publicly, is between Barack and I say, take a victory lap, man. We got to let people know. We got to let people know what was done because they don't know it.
There's certainly more public support for the Affordable Care Act now. I think people came around to realize how valuable it was because they tried to take it away.
Bingo.
But it's still a heavy lift, and industry is going to be vehemently opposed to it. You're still going
to
have to fight a battle.
I'm
so
have
can
to
you talk
fight
a little
like
bit
hell.
About what your plan is for that?
Well, my plan is for that to do what I've always done, and that is be able to convince people. I've been pretty good at it. I find it interesting. My opposition says, yeah, it's true. Joe has put together more bipartisan agreements than anybody. But that was the old days. It was 3 years ago with regard to, for example, the Cures Act, which came up after he was elected and 2 weeks before he got sworn in, convincing 398 folks in the House to vote for it when initially it started out with 119, as well as, 89 senators, 90 senators, don't hold me the exact number, when it started off with 48. It's called persuasion. Presidents are supposed to be able to persuade. And what's happening now is the Carney Show's gone through town once, and they found out there's no pee under any of the three shells. It's coming back again. And people are going, ooh, I didn't know that. You mean to tell me they did this and did that? Part of it is the president, God love him, Barack, had everything land on his desk but locusts. I mean, everything. Look what's happened. We were about to go into a major, major depression. I remember getting chastised because I said, this is the greatest recession in the history of the nation short of a depression. All right, Biden's exact. It was.
At this point in the series, you may have noticed we like to ask the candidates more personal questions, including who has broken your heart. We do this to get a better sense of who they are off the debate stage. Part of the job of president requires a humanity that can't be measured by career experience and policy plans. Joe Biden's life has also been shrouded in personal tragedy. Just weeks before entering the Senate, his first wife and daughter were killed in a car accident. During his second term as vice president, his son, Beau, an Iraq War veteran and former Delaware attorney general, died of brain cancer at just age 46. Asking who has broken your heart to someone like Joe Biden was somewhat of a gamble.
I can tell you what has broken my heart, but it's not someone who's broken it. It broke my heart when my son died. It broke my heart when I was unable to do anything about it. I left the house and I got a call saying my wife and daughter are dead. I don't know whether to be completely straight with you and how you'll... I learned a lesson a long time ago that was a friend I had, a really good friend. We were in high school, and he was a trouble guy, but I was always... He lived down the block from me, and he got in an accident when he was drinking and killed a guy who was riding shotgun, hit a tree, and the fellow died. He was hospitalized a long time, and I was the only one that would go see him. After he was out and recovered, and I insisted that the guys that we hung around with before, that they bring him back, they allow him to come back into the fold. I remember we were sitting, like in the high school days, when you got five guys in a car going home after whatever we were doing, and got in an argument, and he turned around and he said something really mean to me. And I remember going home, it hurt me more than anything that had happened to me before. Because I thought this guy was my soulmate. Remember my dad saying to me, Joey, you're always going to be disappointed if you hold people to the same standard you hold yourself to. You're going to be disappointed. Don't expect that people are going to necessarily be prepared to appear in the second editions of Profiles in Courage. And that's the only time from that point on I never let anyone, man or woman, hurt me. You know, and I get criticized, as you know, and even some serious press people who are not being negative with me say Biden doesn't hold a grudge. Well, you know that old saying, you know, seek revenge, you got two victims. You're one of them. And I've never done that because it's just not worth the effort. But I've not been hurt by a woman or a man. But what's hurt me is, look, a lot of you have been through a lot more than I've been through, too. It's not just me. I have a cartoon on my desk. It's about the size of this insert. I guess I was feeling sorry for myself. My dad was over my home. This was 20 years after the accident. He thought I was just too down. He went up to a local Hallmark store and came back. You know, you get sell the things like this that have a gold frame around them in glass. And then two etchings in it from the funny papers, Hagar the Horrible. And there's a picture of Hagar and the One standing there, and his Viking ship had crashed onto the rocks, and the mast was down, his horns and his helmet were charred, and he's leaning up, he's going, "Why me, God?" And a voice from heaven says, "Why not? Why not you? Why not me? What makes me so special that I think somehow I should be exempt from when other people do it?" I still have it on my desk, and I've reprinted it for a lot of people. You just got to get up. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to get so. Anyway, there isn't anybody that is any woman or man since I've been a high school kid that has really hurt me.
More from our interview after a quick break.
This podcast is supported by Tenderfoot TV. Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where the new podcast To Die For begins. Hosted by Neil Strauss, To Die For takes listeners inside the dark and dangerous world of Russian sex espionage, where targets are seduced for their secrets, and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, the producers of To Live and Die in L.A., binge To Die For now on all podcast platforms.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at The New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at The New York Times work on every day, to give you clarity and perspective, and above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to The New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome back to The Choice.
You've campaigned on your ability to handle a crisis. If China were to send troops and tanks into Hong Kong to violently crack down on peaceful protesters, how would you handle that?
First thing I'd do is go to the United Nations. I would introduce resolutions to condemn them for their actions. I would, in fact, try to reestablish the kind of relationship when we left we had with Japan, South Korea, Indonesia, and Australia. I would move American warships into the region like we were trying to do, to take 60% of our fleet and have it in Asia, to make it clear to him that he, in fact, is not going to be able to go any further, that there's a price to pay if he were to do that. I would do the same thing I did when he set up the air identification zone and I went over to meet with him. And I said, "You got to just understand, we're not," he said, "You, what do you expect me to do, take it down?" I said, "No, but we're going to fly through it. We flew B-53 through it, F-15s through it. Make it clear, we're not playing that game. We are not going to do it." And I would spend the time doing what we've absolutely shredded. I would get the rest of our allies in the world to join us in dealing with sanctions against China. We make up 15% of the world's economy. There's another 25% that are allies that we have dissed already. They're wondering who the hell, where we are. I would try to put back together the coalition, and I would, in fact, make it clear what I said to him in my private meetings, and they've been public. We are a Pacific power. He said, "Why do you say that?" I said, "Because we are a Pacific power. And you would have never had the economic stability you were able to accomplish but for the fact we, the United States, kept the peace." I would make it very clear there's going to be a price to pay in terms of his economy and in terms of the access to other opportunities that China badly needs. Look, we always talk about China, and there's an 800-pound gorilla and what they're doing. China has more problems than we could ever contemplate. They don't have enough water. They're talking about close to a $1 trillion project to turn rivers around. 40% to 45% of the land is polluted with cadmium. They cannot produce crops. They are out now deciding that they're in a position where they have 1 million Uyghurs in essentially jail and re-education camps in the West. They're in a situation where they're having trouble figuring out how do they hold on to the Tibetan area without getting into conflict with India. They have a lot of problems, a lot of problems. We should be making it clear that we're not going to do anything to accommodate what they're doing and make it much more difficult for them to engage in how they proceed. It requires diplomacy, requires a show of our resolve that this is where it stops, and it raises a big question about what to do after that. We'll see what happens.
Some have said that a move like that against Hong Kong would also threaten Taiwan. Do you see that?
No, I do. I absolutely do think it could. And I think it will do the opposite on Taiwan. I think the Taiwanese government will move to try to be more combative with China than it was before, because that's all he talked to me about. I've spent more time, allegedly, with Xi Jinping than any world leader has before we left office, just because the president wanted me to get to know him. He was the vice president. I was vice president. It wasn't appropriate for the president. So they tell me at the State Department I had 25 hours of private dinners with him. He's not a stupid fella. But he also, they're not a democratic small d bone in his body. And he'd ask questions like, do you really control your military? Do you? They didn't control the military. The president didn't. The party controlled the military. Do you really? Do governors have any power? They don't have any power. That's why they're annexing big chunks. They have no independent authority to do anything. What is your national security team? What's the National Security Council do? I mean, these are the questions.
Joe Biden has been a vocal opponent to Facebook and their resistance to fact-check ads. He himself has been a victim of false ads on the social network. As we grilled him further on his approach to dealing with big tech, you'll hear Mr. Biden refer to Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. Section 230 is a law that acts as a limited liability shield that internet platforms like Facebook have benefited from since 1996.
October, your campaign sent a letter to Facebook regarding an ad that falsely claimed that you'd blackmailed Ukrainian officials to not investigate your son. I'm curious, did that experience dealing with Facebook and their power, did that change the way that you see the power of tech platforms right now?
No, I've never been a fan of Facebook, as you probably know. I've never been a big Zuckerberg fan. I think he's a real problem. He knows better. And, you know, from my perspective, I've been of the view that not only we should be worrying about the concentration of power, we should be worrying about the lack of privacy and them being exempt, which you're not exempt. You can't write something you knowing to be false and being exempt from being sued, but he can. The idea that it's a tech company is that Section 230 should be revoked immediately, should be revoked, number one, for Zuckerberg and other platforms.
That's a pretty foundational law of the modern platform-based internet.
Exactly right. And it should be revoked. It should be revoked. Because it is not merely an internet company. It is propagating falsehoods they know to be false. And we should be setting standards, not unlike the Europeans are doing, relative to privacy. You guys still have editors. I'm sitting with them. Not a joke. There is no editorial impact at all on Facebook. None. None whatsoever. It's irresponsible. It's totally irresponsible.
If there's proven harm that Facebook has done, should someone like Mark Zuckerberg be submitted to criminal penalties, perhaps?
He should be submitted to civil liability and his company to civil liability, just like you would be here at the New York Times. Whether he engaged in something that amounted to collusion, that in fact caused harm that would in fact be equal to a criminal offense, that's a different issue. That's possible. That's possible it could happen. Zuckerberg finally took down those ads that Russia was running, all those bots about me. They're no longer being run. He was getting paid a lot of money to put them up. I've learned three things. Number one, Putin doesn't want me to be president. Number two, Kim Jong-il thinks I should be beaten to death like a rabid dog. And three, this president of the United States is spending millions of dollars to try to keep me from being the nominee. I wonder why.
So that was most of the editorial board's interview with former Vice President Joe Biden. To read the full conversation, visit nytimes.com/endorsements. That's endorsements with an S. If you want to hear what the board thought of Mr. Biden, and for an explanation of that Hyde Amendment argument we got into, check out today's deliberation episode. Tomorrow's episode is our last, and it's a big one. We'll weigh the pros and cons of every candidate and decide who we will endorse. We can't wait to share it with you.
The Choice is produced by At Will Media. Mitch Bluestein, Molly Socha, Ashley Taylor, and Rachel Leitner, with help from Michelle Mason. Mixing by Lauren Gardner, and original music by Allison Leighton Brown. Special thanks to Tyson Evans from The New York Times. Our executive producers are Will Malnati from At Will Media and Phoebe Lett from The New York Times. Finally, we want to hear from you. Please rate and review us on the Apple Podcasts app. It'll help more voters find the show.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro. Easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.